Okay, we're off and running. Today is August 9th, 2007, last I checked. And we had the pleasure today of talking with Rose Zavril. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Mm-hmm.
And we're at her lovely house here on 2nd Avenue in Fairbanks. So Rose,
Second Street.
Oh, that's right. It is 2nd Street. So thank you for taking time to do this, Rose. Let's back up to tell us about your background. Tell us a little bit about where you were born and where you grew up.
I was the first Burke to be born in the city of Nenana. I was number 6, and my birth date is January 28, 1928. After my birth, my dad subcontracted to raise mink for the Seattle Fur Exchange, and then we moved from our house in the city to the mink farm below Nenana. I'd say it's probably about a mile or so from the business district of Nenana, and we did not leave there until I was 5 years old, and then we moved back in the city. Daddy gave up on trying to raise mink, and he was, I think, next to the last person to stop doing that. Many people around Nenana during the Depression had tried to raise mink, but it wasn't a lucrative business. So my dad had got into carrying mail, or I think he probably was carrying mail before he took that contract to raise mink, and then he we lived down there, and he raised mink and carried mail during the winter months. And then I really am not sure when Dad made his last mail run, but I think it was probably when I was around 7, because he had to tie his animals at a place. There was no space on our property to house the dogs, so he had a deal with a man named Cooney, Mike Cooney, that had a huge barn, and that was where Dad kept the dogs, because I know he would have to go down there and hook up his team, you know, before he left on a mail run. Whereas when we lived on a farm, he kept the dogs there. And I don't believe there was any ordinance against keeping the dogs in the city, but there was just simply no room for them. And I really can't tell you exactly when my dad stopped carrying the mail. I know there were other people, but I can't remember who they were that carried mail, but they had different routes. Daddy went out toward Ophir McGrath, and I know there was another route down the Tanana River to Tolavana and Manly Hot Springs, but I don't know who the carriers were there. I know Mike Cooney carried mail, but as to what his route was, I don't know. Excuse me. So, you know, my knowledge of Daddy's career in mail carrying is pretty limited. I know he did it when he lived down the Yukon River before moving to Nenana, but, you know, that was so long ago, and nearly all the people that knew my father are gone. You know, they've all died. Because, you know, my dad would be 121 years old if he were still living. So that, you know, and this, you know, these things happened probably 62 years ago. And I have a pretty good memory after, you know, of many things, but not of that because I was pretty young.
Mm-hmm. The mail carriers were bonded in the old days.
I think they were because they had to be, didn't you?
Yeah, I think they did.
Because they carried registered mail and stuff like that and some valuable things. I know they had to go down to the post office and then load up, I remember. But I think when Dad hooked up the team and left, he just left directly from the post office, as I remember it. Because I remember him coming into the cabin when we lived down on the farm, and he'd kiss us kids and Mama goodbye, and then we never saw him again until he came back in. And sometimes he'd be gone for a long time in the winter. Well, you know, 2 days in the kid's life's a long time, but I know I was told sometimes it'd be 3 months because of trail conditions and weather. And, you know, I can't tell you where the end of my dad's route was even.
Yeah.
But I do remember him speaking of Ophir and McGrath. And I know one other thing I remember is he carried personal stuff, like people along the way where he stopped overnight, they would ask him to pick up different things from the stores in Indiana, and then when he came back out, he'd bring them these things they asked for. He told us about this couple. It was the man was white and the woman was native, and she didn't speak much English. But Daddy, he stayed there overnight, and he asked us lady if there was anything she wanted from Nana. And she said yes, and she kept saying something, telling Daddy what she wanted, but neither Dad or her husband could understand her. And she said she wanted peace potter. And they had to repeat it over and over again. Neither of them could figure out what peace potter was. So finally Daddy said she went over to the cupboard and got a cup or a bowl out of the cupboard and put her fingers in it and then dabbed it here and there and smoothed it over her face. And then they figured out she meant face powder. And Daddy said he never could understand why she wanted face powder when they were out in the wilderness with no near neighbors. He said he didn't know who she was going to impress with her makeup. But I never will forget him telling that story because I heard it many times he'd tell visitors about it. But you know, I'm at a complete loss because all these things took place so long ago and I was so young when they happened that I have a hard time trying to remember anything outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've done great so far. Please don't feel badly about this. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is we're reconstructing a long time ago.
Yeah.
You had mentioned to me on the phone about Carl Sasui and his wife.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, this man came to our house one time to visit, I guess he came in by dog team, because that would have been the only way he came in, possibly by air, but I just don't think so. And he was such a gentleman. I'll always remember that. He was not a real big man, but he was very healthy, and he had the most beautiful pair of fur mukluks I've ever seen. They were knee length, and he was so polite to my mother. And Daddy thought the world of this fellow, and if I remember correctly, he was Japanese. I know how his name was spelled. It was S-E-S-S-U-E. Mm-hmm. And I have a real close friend in town that was born in Japan. I never have thought to ask her about that name if it sounds, you know, like it could be Japanese. But I know that this Carl Susui was married to an Indian woman, if I remember right. And whether they had children or not, I don't know, because I only saw that man that one time when he came to Nenana during the winter. And but Daddy spoke of him frequently, and they were pretty good friends.
There was a roadhouse at Tulita where Carl Susui may have lived at that time.
Could have been.
Or it could have been Lake Minchumina, too.
I don't think it was Minchumina, but Daddy used to speak about Knight's Roadhouse because he stopped there. And if I remember right, that Knight was named Henry Knight.
Yes.
Yeah, but I never met the man or saw him as far as I know.
Well, what did he say about Henry?
Well, nothing much. He would just, you know, be talking to grown-ups, and none of the people they were discussing meant a thing to me. But Dad would, there must have been people living in close proximity to that roadhouse because they would visit. And when Daddy first came to Nenana, well, after he'd been there and established his mail carrying, he sent for my mom. She didn't go up immediately. And then Daddy went up in the summer after he got there. He sent for Mom and the three kids. They were living in either at Ruby or Galena. And they came in Nenana. My mother hated the place. She didn't speak very much English, and the native folks there didn't speak her dialect. So she didn't like Nenana and had such a fit that Daddy had to take her with him out on the mail trail. And she lived out there. She was out there long enough to give birth to two little boys that died. One was stillborn, and then the next one was just lived a couple of days. So when she was expecting me, my dad said, "That's enough," and he made her go back to Nenana with my two sisters and brothers, and she had to stay there till I was born. And as far as I know, she never went back out. But she told me that wherever they were at Roosevelt, a place called Roosevelt, and there was a roadhouse there, because she said my older brother used to wander to the roadhouse, and one time another mail carrier, I guess, was stopping there, and he got to talking to the owner of the roadhouse and discovered that my brother was Bill Burke's son. So he gave him $10 as a gift. So my brother went back home and he told my mom that some white guy at the roadhouse had talked to him and gave him some gave him a present, and Mom said, "Well, what did he give you?" "Oh, just some old green paper." So Mom said, "Well, where is it?" Choked, and he said, "Oh, I threw it away. It was no good." So Ma said, went back, and they hunted and hunted, and finally found the $10. But the money was just worthless out there anyway. You couldn't spend it on anything.
You had mentioned that Carl Sasui's wife made those sheepskin...
Yeah, she made booties. They were worn over your stocking feet and inside of fur mukluks or moose hide mukluks. And I guess he went hunting for mountain sheep, because I never knew of anyone else around town making them. I guess they were available, but I wasn't allowed to trace all over the town when I was a kid. And long ago, you didn't go to the Indian village except by invitation. My mother had a friend up there, so she went up there, but the railroad tracks was a dividing line between the city and, there was railroad property on the other side called the Marine Ways, and that was on the town side of the railroad trestle where it went up onto the bridge. And on the other side of the bridge towards St. Mark's Mission was the Indian village. And no natives ever built homes on the Marine Wayside, excepting one person named Henry Thomas. And how he was allowed to build there, I don't know. But I know for as long as I can remember, he was on the wrong side of the bridge, you might say. But later on, as years went on, other people built homes in there. And now there are no restrictions as far as I know. In fact, most of that native village, as I remember, it isn't there anymore because the river took away all the St. Mark's property. It cut into it, and the main dormitory and main building at St. Mark's floated down the river. I think it was in 1960. The banks were undercut, and it carried that main building. It was a large building, two wings, and it went right by the city of Nenana.
That's the clock we're hearing in the background.
Yeah, I know it.
Just singing to us.
Yeah.
Well, so you're saying that the village of Nenana was separated between, it was a native section and a white section?
Yeah. No native children in the village attended school at Nenana, the public school. They all went to the mission school. And then in 1946, the first native kid attended the school in Nenana. I remember it distinctly because his mother rented a house a block above ours, and he was the first native kid from the village, born of one of the women in the village that attended the a school at Nenana, in the city of Nenana. Now, my mother was Indian, but she was married to a white man. So that way, I was allowed to attend the school. Plus, there were other children with a white, one white parent, and they were allowed to go to the public school at Nenana also. I don't know if that was the law, or if, you know, it was just an understanding that was, you know, put in place before I was ever born. But I know no children of the village attended the school at Nenana. And it was a territorial school. But after, as like I say, after 46, that was the first I ever knew of a village-born kid going to the school that in the town of Nenana.
How much intermarriage was there at that time?
In close proximity to us, there was my mom and a neighbor on either side. They were, the one was Kobuk and the other one was half Indian. But, and then one, two, three, right offhand, I would say there were three other Native women married to white men. That's, let's see, Olets, Dozets, and Burchards, Burks, Duns, Shades. But, and the Sheldons. Their mom was Indian. But that's the only ones I can bring to mind right offhand.
Well, what was the status of you children of mixed heritage?
There was no discrimination or anything. We weren't treated any differently than the white kids were.
Uh-huh.
None of that stuff came up till the Second World War.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know why some of the kids I grew up with, the girls, they didn't want to say that they were half Native and they were claiming Spanish descent and French.
Mm-hmm.
I might have done it too if my mom wasn't everywhere I was. I couldn't get 10 feet away from my mother. She was pretty vigilant as far as I was concerned. But and it wasn't real nasty or anything, you know, because when I was in my teens, I didn't have much time to trace around, get into mischief, because I had to take care of the wood and water situation at our home, and we had a furnace and a wood-burning cook stove, and I had to saw and cut all the wood because my brother wasn't home. He was in the army and my dad was away from home. Once construction season started, Daddy worked away from home during the winter.
Mm-hmm. But backing up to, did your mom ever talk about what her job was in terms of the mail run, in terms of chores that she had to do related to the dogs?
No, not really. She had little kids, so she couldn't do a great deal. I imagine when Dad was out there at Roosevelt, I imagine she helped, but I don't think so because she might have, I don't really know, but I know when we lived down on the mink farm, Dad always had a couple of men staying there to attend the mink and cook dog feed for the dogs that he didn't have with him. And then when he was in town, in between runs, these same people took care of the dog feed. But I remember that my mother's brother, who lived with us as a family member, and my older brother had to go out and help feed the dogs, because Dad had an awful lot of dogs. And it would, you know, 2 men would take a long time to feed that many animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they, when they're on the trail, my dad fed the dog dried fish, but when he was in town, and those dogs he didn't take on the run, they had cooked feed. They cooked cornmeal and fish and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. And then he also used to have 5-gallon containers of tallow, and he'd supplement the feed with tallow. I don't remember how it was fed to them, if it was put in the feed itself or if it was fed to them as is. But I remember those huge round cans with the tallow in them. But he had to get all of that stuff shipped up for the mink and the dogs. Mm-hmm. Well, that was why raising mink just didn't earn enough money for the expense it was in taking care of them. Because the feed had to be brought in from Seattle. Mm-hmm.
What about the clothing your dad wore when he was a mail carrier?
Well, he used to wear, well, a long time ago, the only fabrics were wool and cotton. And Daddy wore heavy wool pants, long johns, and then he always had a drill parka. It was probably mid-thigh with a big pocket in front. And then he wore moose hide boots and mittens. He had a big, huge pair of bearskin mitts some lady on the trail made him. But I don't know if he ever really wore them. Seemed like they were in pretty good shape the last time that I ever remember seeing them. And then he wore beaver caps, and all of his parkas had hoods on them. They were made of a kind of a khaki-colored canvas, and they were real heavy. And then he wore a jacket underneath them. And then the mittens had the idiot strings on them that, you know, when he would stop, he'd just wrap the mittens across each other in the back and they'd stay there. But he had other, you know, light mittens or gloves he wore inside of those big ones. Mm-hmm. And then Mom made moose hide mitts for him too, and then he had wool inserts that went inside of them. Then later on, he got leather ones, so Mom didn't really have to make those for him anymore.
What about dog moccasins?
Oh, those were made of canvas. And boy, I saw Mom make so many of those. She'd sit at the sewing machine for a couple days in her spare time from her other household duties and crank those things out. And I remember Daddy had some kind of a drawstring bag, and when the road, the trail was icy, especially, you know, in the spring of the year when it thaws and freezes, it would raise came the dog's paws, so Dad had to have those on him. Yeah. He had another thing, a contraption. It was like, I forgot what he called them, but it was for females. It was some kind of a padded, quilted affair that you pulled up under their bellies and fastened up on the with straps across the back. And I remember wondering what in the world that thing was, and he said that was for females that had puppies because it wouldn't freeze their nipples. Uh-huh. So that was protection for them. Mm-hmm. But
did your mom make those?
No, I don't think so. I don't know where Daddy got them, but I only remember seeing the one that looked like such a odd thing that I was pretty curious about. And Dad, I forgot what my dad called the thing, a belly band or something. I don't remember.
What were the moccasins made out of?
The Canvas.
Canvas.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but the canvas was like fuzzy on one side, you know, like they just weren't canvas. They were on the underside. They had felt so, sort of like flannel. And I know that the material itself was real heavy, because my mom broke some needles, fooling that they get weak after so long, guessing would pop. She'd get so mad and she'd have to replace a needle in her sewing machine.
Yeah.
In fact, my daughter has Mama's sewing machine at her house.
Does she?
Yeah, so that thing was bought sometime in the mid-30s.
Huh.
Yeah. I know it cost my daughter $500 to have it refinished.
Wow. So that was the old foot pedal kind?
Yeah, treadle machine.
Yeah.
I remember the name, brand name was Damascus.
I'll be dying.
Oh, Sue, everyone, all the women in the neighborhood had to come over to Burke's and look at that new sewing machine.
Oh, that's wild. So he kept his dogs at Cooney's place, huh?
Yeah, I don't know what they called it. My mom and dad always called it the dog barn.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one block in from Main Street, I remember, and probably a block up from where the Tortella Lodge is now in Enana, but on the opposite side of the road from the Tortella. So yeah, that's right. It was a block above there.
So he would have to hook up the dogs and run them down to the post office and pick up the mail, huh?
Yeah.
Boy, that must have been something with a big string
of
dogs.
Yeah, he had two sleds. He had the big sled and then another, like a Yukon sled. And then when he had a big, big load, he'd have to use a Ouija board to guide the team. And then when my dad died, my brother took that Ouija board. I'm surprised it was still around the place, but my brother said that was the only souvenir he wanted of my dad's was that Ouija board. My dad may have had it at his house, and my brother found it and took it. Now it's hard to say what's become of it, because my brother died in 1980.
How did he get his sleds?
He had them built. There were people around there that built them. He didn't build any. My uncle built what they call like a racing sled or just a basket sled. But as far as I know, my dad never built any of his sleds. He had someone do it, and who they were, I don't know. But I know Dad built his own sleds for hauling wood.
Yeah.
Double enders.
So why did he give up the mail contract, did you say?
Well, the airplanes came in, and I don't know whether they phased out Dad's route or what, but he just got into doing other stuff, and I know, because he had the wood business, and he could make more money hauling wood filling out wood contracts than he could carrying the mail and going out all winter long and being away from home, or even with him having hauling wood like that, it kept him away from home a lot during the winter.
Yeah.
He'd come to town, spend a night, if he had business to take care of, and take a bath, and go back down.
Stop here.
She must have some scandal to relate to. She rarely calls me. Yeah.
We're back on now. I just clicked it back on. So let's see. You think it was the wood contract that became lucrative?
Probably, you know, he could do better at that. And then when the war broke out, he hired out to go out working on construction jobs. That didn't last all winter, but he went out early in the year and left. I know he wouldn't get back home till sometimes the 1st of November. And then he'd probably take off in maybe March or April.
And then you said that in your life that you ended up at Northway, was it, during the...
No, I worked there in 1943. I hired out as a waitress at a construction camp. And I stayed there from June till September. I had to come back to Nenana to go to school. And then the next year, 44, after I finished up on the ice pool and school let out, I came to Fairbanks and I went to work for the same company at Ladd Field. And I worked there till July, I think it was, and then I moved to what later became Eielson. I worked out there till the end of August. And then I went back to Nenana and for school again.
You were telling me about the Russian pilots, the Lend-Lease program.
Yeah. Yeah, they were ferrying airplanes up from Great Falls, Montana, and they were bringing them in to Ladd Field. And Northway was right on the beam. There were military aircraft in and out of there around the clock. And I saw lots of fighter planes being brought up. And then later on, I saw them in Fairbanks, and they were under camouflage. But when they came through Northway on their way to Fairbanks, they were the OD color. But there's a whole bunch of them come in at once. And just I don't know what schedule they were on, but it seemed that that airfield was busy all the time. And 43, they were extending it. They were lengthening that airstrip at Northway because of the activity, you know, bringing those planes up here. And then they camouflaged them, and they became fighter planes. I remember in Nenana, I guess it might have been 44. I think it was in 44. It could have been late fall of 43. Two Russian planes flew under the railroad bridge.
Oh, gosh.
My God, what a racket. They used to overfly Nenana. I don't know how they'd do that. If they must have been off their route or something, but these two guys dared each other to fly under the railroad bridge. And they did it, and my God, it was a horrible racket they made. In fact, I thought they had crashed, a plane had crashed. And it just happened that this one guy that had lived in Nenana for many, many years was Russian by birth. And he had his shortwave radio on. He understood what those pilots were saying. And they were daring each other to fly under the bridge, and one did and the other followed. That's the only time I've ever heard of any planes flying under that bridge. But I know Everybody came flying out of their houses. We're all standing on our porches asking what the heck was going on. Then later that same day, we learned that Jack Kamaloff had heard those pilots on the radio.
Let me ask you one more question about your dad. You said that he gave up the mail contract, but then used dogs later for a census?
I really can't pinpoint the year, but I remember there was a lot of preparation and stuff for him to get ready to go. A lot of paperwork, if I remember.
Do you know where he headed that time?
As best I can remember, he was going out the same way he carried mail. You know, so I don't know where Daddy's route ended, actually. So, you'd probably have a better idea of those routes than I do, if you've studied on it.
Well, it's hard to determine exactly where he went. There were reports of him all along the trail.
Yeah. Well, you know, see, he carried on the Yukon River, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a mystery there, but...
Yeah.
Well, this has been very good. I was particularly interested in your comments about the division of Nenana and the Native Village and the other. And one of the things I've been interested in is that the dog team mail carriers, many of them had Native families. You know, they were intermarried.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered if that was gave them and their families special privilege in an age where there was a lot of discrimination.
I don't know how much discrimination there was actually in my mother's day, because the only time she was actually involved with whites was when she went to Ruby, because she, from what I can understand, didn't go to school. And I don't know where they wintered, but there was a school there. And when her and her sisters and brothers were there, they went for a very short time because her father was a trapper. And so they didn't stay. And I never have been able to determine where the heck they were, you know, when she attended school. Because I think there had to be a certain number of students before it warranted them establishing the school.
Right.
Because for many years there wasn't a school at Manly Hot Springs. But then when my brother decided to put his kids through school, his stepchildren went to the Mount Edgecombe. But when his family got a school age, they wintered in Manly Hot Springs, and then they were able to have a school, because then his kids brought the population up. Yeah, but then they always went back to the Kantishna and his fish camp on the Tana during the summer months.
But going back to your dad and mom, for you kids, growing up in Nenana, what was that like in terms of relations with the white population, the totally white population?
Oh, we weren't treated any differently than anybody else. They never, all the half-breed kids weren't treated any differently than white kids. And there were not many people around Nenana of Eskimo descent. One of Mama's friends and neighbors was Chinese Eskimo, and she was married to a guy from Switzerland.
I mean,
but She was highly intelligent, that lady was. Mm-hmm. Mom was poorly educated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But she, you know, when us kids learned to read in school, she learned along with us. Mm-hmm. Daddy encouraged us kids to read out loud. He said it was good training, so we wouldn't be backward and know how to speak correctly. But he also wanted Mom to teach us to speak Indian, which she never did.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for all of this information. This has been
scuttlebutt.
No, it's fascinating.
Oh, I'm sorry. This can be my, you know, like I say, I'll be 80 in January, and good heavens, all this happened well over 60 years ago.
I know, it's hard, but you've put some pieces together for me that'll be helpful.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that.
No, like I say, the last one I ever know carrying mail by dog team was Charlie Shade, mm-hmm. and he lived next door to us. But I think Mike Cooney also carried the mail, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, Mike did, and I've got records of their contracts. And Charlie's.
Mike Cooney was mayor of the town at one point, I remember.
Oh, he died.
Yeah. And Henry Kaiser, the man that ran the power plant at Nenana, had served in the Army with my dad. They were both in the Signal Corps. He has a daughter living here in town.
Good. Well, I'm going to shut this off now, but thank you very much.